Good evening, everyone. It's Wednesday night and it's 7 o'clock, and we're in our 11th week of our unfolding of the Secret Talks Volume 5, Work of Groups by E.J. Gold. So, I don't know where you are. If you happen to be listening to this as an archival event, you could be anywhere. And in a certain way, no matter where you are, at that particular moment, there's like a connection with this particular space. It's happening May 31st, 2017, on the west coast of the United States of America, which exists this particular year. We don't know what it'll be like when you happen to read this, because the digital saving of this will probably outlast everything. But the point of it is that we're taking a book that E.J. wrote entitled Work of Groups, and we're discerning the various elements of group work. And Marvette, do we have anything in here to read?
You do.
Okay. Robin, do you want to read that?
Sure.
And what we do, we open the class with
Minutes of the previous meeting. Wednesday, 5/24, Work of Groups, week number 10. 1, operations of a group. Small one. Element of a group is persistence or constancy, which creates a fluidity of working together. I can depend on each in the group to do what they do. The willingness of constancy. 2, the atmosphere of the group creates a mirror of operation or excellence. When we come together, it's as serious operatives. 3, hospitality and courtesy are the first interactions with anyone in a school with someone else. Hospitality and courtesy are the first interactions with anyone in a school with someone else. Maybe she meant of anyone in a school with someone else. Did that mean someone else outside the school or inside the school?
Well, the first interaction is the hospitality.
Hospitality and courtesy are the first interactions with anyone in the school.
That's the preamble to coming into a group. Okay. Is that's your first encounter, is some form of a hospitality.
Yeah, okay. Well, that's what I always felt that way about answering the phone, for the IDHHB. It's necessary to have a certain attitude to do it. Okay, 4, when a group comes together and works, we start at a higher level. There's an agreement of an operating base. And then 2, this actually was, Roman numeral 1 was operations of a group. Roman numeral 2 is function of a group. 1, to find possible candidates for the work. And that was the content of the talk that we went over last week, right?
Mm-hmm.
That was the message.
Yeah. So this chapter, what we'd like to do is, that'll go to what we'd like to do today is spend a little bit of time actually on chapter 25, and we're going to go ahead and read through the chapter. Are you gentlemen able to read with us a little bit? On the phone?
Yes, absolutely.
Thank you. Okay. Ivan, why don't you get us started, read until you want to pause.
Okay.
Then maybe Silverdale, Harry, and then I will go.
Chapter 25, on questions. G told us to only ask him questions that were important to us. question came up about the essence being in the muscles. Someone asked whether the psyche might also be in the muscles, as changing the posture or amount of muscle tension changes the personality. Gee, this just shows that essence is greater than personality. Personality is in the nervous system. Essence is in the muscles. How do you know I am not a charlatan? F. I know you are from watching you sell carpets. G had been selling carpets and antiquities that day, telling people all kinds of fantastic stories.
Go ahead.
G laughed. I always give people what they expect when they buy carpets. F. In a work sentence, I know you are not a charlatan. G. Why? F. Because sometimes when you are talking, you remind me of something I already know, rather than telling me something I have never heard of. Something I know, but could not put into words. Harry?
G. Only for those ideas about which we do not lie to ourselves, we can see whether or not others lie. Where we are not able to be impartially honest, we cannot know. F. Before finding your work, spiritual books were just speculation and philosophy, just something interesting to read. But now, reading back over them, they have meaning. They are real. G. It is not shameful not to know the sense and aim of life. It is shameful to know and not to do.
Okay. G then had us ask him questions we were frequently asked in study groups. He said he would show us how to deal with superficial questions. As we asked each question, most of which were questions we as group leaders had been asked many times, he replied sarcastically, humorously, coldly, cleverly, always in a way designed to show the person the superficiality of his question, perhaps embarrass the person a little, but force him to dig deeper. He turned the questions back on the questioner. Go ahead.
After a couple of hours of this demonstration of how to run a study group, we were all weak from laughter. Then G told us, once again, to ask him questions that were important to us. He said that real questions could not be ridiculed. All real questions demand answers, and he is constrained by law to answer all essence questions, questions which come from I. Only I has the right to demand and receive answers, he added. C was in the kitchen cooking. Although it was 2 a.m., we all crowded into the dining room and had a huge meal. Sounds to me like we lived happily ever after.
And they lived happily. At 2 a.m., starting at 2 a.m. in the morning. I read an article recently about Simon and Garfunkel being inducted into the Hall of one of the Hall of Fames, maybe it was Rock and Roll or whatever it was.
Yeah.
But and their group, Simon and Garfunkel, were a tremendous force during the period that they were operating. But then they had a personal break that was very significant and really could not come back again. They did a few things later, but they couldn't reunite us. And so Garfunkel, who happened to be a mathematician, quit the group and went to teach math up in Connecticut or some damn thing like that, right? And he said, the problem was I was teaching these math kids, these students math, and the only thing they wanted to ask me was, what was it like to know the Beatles? And it made me realize that the whole subject of questions is a remarkable area, and it's something that maybe we can help each other develop a skill in asking the question. And because first, these guys, it was supposed to be a math class, but for those students, it wasn't. It was a class, it was an event with a celebrity. Mm-hmm. And so for them, they didn't even know where they were. So I started thinking about the idea of questions, and in this particular conversation, there's a couple of questions that, categories that EJ talked about, the types of questions that are superficially in the open groups, right?
Yeah.
Like in the study groups. And then he said, then there are real questions. So part of our job tonight is to define the difference. What the heck is a real question?
Well, I mean, and this, the most obvious thing about this talk, the transcription of this talk, is that it's lacking several hours of the examples of the superficial questions.
And
I mean, what is the reason for that?
And very likely hours of real questions that may have been.
It isn't clear to me whether they did.
In the last paragraph?
Did it suggest that they came up with real questions at the end?
Yeah. Then G told us once again to ask him questions that were important to us. He said that real questions are not critical. So I assumed that during that period of the evening, they started asking him questions that maybe fell into this other.
Yeah, maybe that's why it took till 2 a.m.
Yeah. So there were the superficial questions, and then the other questions. So when I was thinking about the whole idea, it's like, people can ask you a question and then you can respond to it.
Right? Yes.
I mean, that seems to be like, what day is it? I'm not trying to pin you down there.
Yeah, all right. Let me think about that.
Yeah, get back to me. And, you know, there's that sort of thing. But EJ's pointing to something else. He's pointing to the arising of a real question from the essential self, right? He's hinting
yes.
at that.
Well, I think that it was a very strong introduction. It was a very strong lead-in to solicit these real questions, okay, to go through a fairly extensive filtering of silly questions or useless or superficial ones. And there's also the indication that it wasn't just a group of people who wanted to know about essence questions. It was a group of people who'd already gone through taking the obligation of being the question answerer. I mean, this is the other thing about being, you know, I can remember going through this experience in Tucson, Arizona, that you know, for whatever foolish whatever reasons you have, for starting a study circle or being the leader of a study circle, you find out that you're in the hot seat. I mean, when if you actually have a functioning study circle, you the responsibility devolves to you to answer questions and do some planning to make something happen.
Or not happen. Yeah.
If I recall. So where do you want to go with this?
So then the other thing I noticed was that sometimes, let's say there's a talk going on or an event going on or an interaction going on, and question, it might be an event that a question arises in you about what is being asked. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Someone's speaking and it makes you think of a question, right? Does that make sense to you, first of all?
You think of a question when someone's speaking.
Speaking, you think of a question.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So what are the markers for such a thing? How do you know? And there are two parts of it that hit me real strong. One, how do you know when this question arises in you? What does it feel like? And then the second thing is, why do we buffer it out so much also? We're talking to somebody, and,
mm-hmm.
and we just buffer the hell out of it because of some reason. We do have a question, but then we stop it. We just don't ask. And that's even more fundamental to the next step of
mm-hmm.
attempting to ask a real question.
Well, I mean, the thought that struck me about this is, again, it isn't clear to me how long they spent or how many essence questions were generated. So, I mean, it seems to me right off the bat, it's so much easier to ask superficial questions, to come up with superficial questions than to arrive at, you know, to figure out what is my essence question. And I think in answer to what you just said, something that I thought was intriguing. I mean, I think that in most of our interactions on the street, you know, at work, whatever, every day, you know, with people that we only know, we don't know particularly well, or we're not in any special kind of a group with them. I think it's generally, it's what we call either courtesy or civility or just manners. You don't ask somebody, you know, you say, well, how are you doing? How's it going? Oh, I'm fine. I've been working kind of hard. I'm tired. I'm this. I'm that. It's like it's generally a very superficial conversation. But you don't except with a certain category of friend, you don't ask somebody, well, are you doing something meaningful this week in your life? You know, or are you satisfied?
Are you doing something meaningful?
Are you satisfied that if you died tomorrow, how would you feel about
like
today
to
if you died? How would you feel about today if you died tomorrow? You know, how many people did you ask that?
Right. So that's one example of like a societal, what would you call that? Just courtesy or norms or something, right? You don't ask, quote unquote, personal questions, right?
Yeah, I mean, we wouldn't commonly call that.
Yes.
We wouldn't commonly say essence questions, but yeah, even something serious, even something that's serious. I mean, that's like what would you call it? That has content for me or that's personal to me. Go ahead.
I think superficial questions many times are very egotistic somehow, and in those, sometimes it includes those, because it's always about the character and like pretending to, sometimes you ask questions just to confirm things that you think you already know, or at times you ask questions kind of like trying to fit in a social situation, and you don't go into deeper questions many times. In my experience, is fear. Is the fear of being judged or of being, like, maybe misunderstood or seen as something that is going outside of what the majority of people is going on with. And there might be other situations, but in a way it's just that it doesn't, there's no a necessity really coming from within to actually, like, it's just kind of like, I don't know, breaking the ice type of question sometimes, or like just commenting on things and trying maybe to show off some knowledge or some capacity with the question, but not really going into, as you said, a deeper understanding of something.
Yeah. So we're going to see that fear is a big element. But what I want to just point out that sometimes the fear comes up and we don't even notice the question arise in us. We're so afraid that we won't even allow it to be asked, even in ourselves. We notice something, and we don't even allow ourselves for the question to arise. And I think this is an important form of self-understanding, self-remembering, or observation, that you remember, observe, how do you buffer out questions? And then you can free yourself if you're allowed to do it. If you're allowed to at least observe your questions. Observe your questions. Maybe that's the only way that your being can speak to you in the midst of something that is uncomfortable, difficult. So allow the questions to come up and notice what they might be. So then, I mean, the second half of this is, well, what is a real question? So I was thinking about for some reason in 400 BC, you know, the graffiti in all these ancient temples, Ivan, was, you know, Nofi Seutan.
Graffiti, maybe.
It was everywhere, apparently. Yeah. It wasn't just on the temple, you know, the oracles.
On the entry.
Entry of oracles.
On the entryway arch or something.
But it was in other places, too. So it was so potent, it was so part of the fabric of society at that time, that it was able to be around a good bit. And, of course, that means that's the... what would you call it, a phrase, a admonition, know thyself. So a couple of years ago, I was sitting down, I had this horrible meditation pillow in my room, and sometimes when I sit on it, it's never pretty. I mean, it's hard for me to sit on the damn thing because my body isn't in very good shape. I sit there, and it's what happens after that's the problem. So for a couple of months, I just worked on this thing, know thyself. And then it led to the question of, who am I? Yeah. So you start asking yourself, well, who am I? And at first, it's easy to ask, right? Who am I?
Okay.
And I know that when I was 20 years old and I had just discovered Madame Blavatsky's work, and I'm sitting there, and on it said, know thyself. It was like the first time I'd ever thought of that. I was 19, 20 years old.
That you thought of answering the question?
No, I didn't quite even forming the question.
Yeah.
At 19, I knew nothing. Yeah. I liked the Dodgers. You know, it was like, but here's the thing, know thyself. I said to my father, I said, you know, that's really simple. You can really do that.
Mm-hmm.
And he kind of leans back. You know, he's known as El Jefe in his tribe. You know, he was the big guy. And he goes, what do you mean? I'm the guy. I'm who I am. I'm the guy that's talking to you.
Right.
And that's why.
And how did you? Well, how did you take that when you were?
I was
19.
Was like the way. Well, it's a good question. The way I took it then, I was baffled, because here's a guy that, you know, was like the chief authority of maleness in my life, and again, you know, he goes, "Of course, I know who I am. I'm the guy that," and he declared it, "I'm the guy that's talking to you." There was no mystery in his voice. And when I read this little thing on the sacred doctrine, and I was reading it, it created mystery in me. And so when I'd sit there on this pillow for a few hours, and this thing, who am I? I started to get afraid. Started to have that fear.
What do you think you were afraid of?
That I didn't know who I was.
Uh-huh, yeah, yeah.
And as soon as you get into that, it's like the seawater is starting. There's something in it that suddenly is not well placed. It's roiling. The water is agitated.
So you've reminded me, I don't know how many other people would relate to this, but you've reminded me that I can't remember what age, but I went through long periods in my childhood when I had a question, which I think was a very serious question for myself as a child, and possibly an essence question, which was basically looking around me and saying, like, why are all of these people, why are all these adults around me not acknowledging it, not saying anything meaningful, not speaking about actual life, about their, I think I was thinking of their inner life, or what their actual experience of life, like what, is this, what are they, is it some kind of show they're putting on, or false front over. So I know I went through long periods thinking that the adults were keeping secrets, that they were not talking about what I really wanted to hear them talk about. And I don't think I actually wanted them to say, but I had questions. And what reminded me of that is that I was absolutely mortified. Yeah, I never figured out any way to formulate that as a question of any kind to any adult.
Well, formulate it as a question.
No, I never had the courage. I never had the courage or the determination to go up to any one single adult in my childhood and say, what are you really about? What's going on?
Except, Ivan, it was a question in you.
Yeah.
It lacked the ability to formulate it as a question. So it was in you. You didn't know what it was. Maybe now you do, 60 years later. But at the time, it was a question, and there was no place to put it. You didn't even know how to even give it the flight of words, so to speak.
I'm formulating it as a question now. I mean, I'm thinking that what I'm thinking now is, I think that I still can have from time to time the same perception. I mean, I can go to Starbucks or whatever, I can go and look around me and have the same perception. But what the difference from this, from being like 8 years old or whatever it was, is that was some huge disturbance that it produced in me at the time.
Okay, that's what I'm interested in.
To perceive that. And I'm thinking now, it's like I'm so used to perceiving it now that I'm not having that disturbance. But I'm going towards your idea about the essence questions. I think the essence question has to arise out of something like an atmosphere, a mood, or an emotion, or atmosphere, or some kind of disturbance of the ordinary personality, the ordinary character, the ordinary subjective, blah, blah, blah. I don't know, whatever.
When I was, and I've told this story many, many times in this class about when I was in Catholic school, and my parents had a conference with the nun about the horrible work I was doing. I'm sure there's never anything good coming from a nun. I mean, that's her penance. And so they put me and my sister in the church while the conference was going on. I've told this story before. There was nobody else there. My sister was sitting beside me, and 5, 8, 10 rows in front of us, pews in front of us, was this guy praying. Quietly praying. He wasn't saying a damn thing. It's just quiet, but you could feel his intensity. So I'm sitting here looking, here's the cross, the crucifix, and all this stuff. And suddenly he throws his arms back in this sign of reverence. At that moment, I became afraid. As I peeked into where he was at, the depth of his reverence was, I saw it. Could I go there? Now, 60 years later, 50, I can't remember how old I was, 55 years later, I remember that clearly and distinctly. Mm. As you did. So I don't want to put anybody in on the place like we...
Well, wait a second, though. Hold on a second. You're talking... I would call that empathy. Wasn't that a resonance, a moment of empathy that you had with that individual?
I did. But it was also like suddenly I saw into a world that I knew nothing about. This world of full-bodied reverence is what I want to call it. And he threw his arms out quietly, respectfully, quietly.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, could I be that in surrender that much? I didn't have that word. I didn't have that word. I didn't know what it meant. So I wanted to ask, so Ivan and I have both recalled moments that I call the arising of a question in our past. I don't want to put anybody on the spot, but can you just reflect back? Can you see some of those moments where a question was arising, whether you had a word for it or not, whether you're able to describe it, formulate it, and then finally to actually ask it, or too difficult. But just the arising of this, like you're sitting face to face with wonder. So if you feel like it, you can just say yes or no or whatever. Is there anybody on tonight, Ben? So it's like a moment to reflect back. What were those questions I had? And those are, to me, those are marker points for parts of our evolution as a voyager. We were guiding our way by noticing those moments. And then we can shift or change or whatever. For you, Ivan, you're baffled when you look around and you see all these brilliant, bright adults talking about nothing of meaning.
You know what I'm trying to think about? It's funny. I think I haven't thought about this for a long time, but I think it would be interesting as an adult to formulate that question. I'm thinking right now that what I wanted to ask all those adults is, like, how can you all walk around and act like this with so little connection with one another? Evidently oblivious of one another, of who the other person is. I think it's because I felt like that, like unacknowledged, like I was having a whole life that absolutely nobody else was interested in or had anything to do with.
But doesn't that have a ring of a real question? There's something about it. It's like it arises out of this rich earth.
I think there's a real question in there, and because I don't know. Actually, I'd be interested in what other people have to say about this. It's like, would this be one of the qualities of a real question? Is that it has, it's rooted in some very visceral or very very emotional or very intense, let's say, experience from a time when you were less mental. See, I'm thinking.
Yes.
I know that. I know that these sensations that I was disturbed by were, you know, where I was not cogitating. I wasn't reasoning about them. I wasn't rationalizing anything. I was disturbed. I was just really disturbed.
There's something in the force field that was disturbing,
yeah,
and you were seeing it.
It was maybe.
Go ahead, Martha.
I think you've pinpointed it, Ivan, because when I think back on a time when I had what might have been a real question, I would say it was, because I never asked it, but it was asked later of EJ in the following year, and he wrote a whole book on it.
Wow.
So when I had it, well, it was about the human biological machine as a transformational apparatus. I had not formulated it in that way, but I had that question with not those exact same words. At a convention we had in 1982 up in the mountains at that camp place, and Ormond McGill was there.
Camp.
But
Ross Reynolds,
it wasn't Ross Reynolds. Ross Reynolds was 1980. This was another campground, and we were up there with a camper because you know we stayed. I think we stayed overnight. Anyways, but that was the quality of being very, very disturbed. Because I wanted to ask it, but I didn't know how to ask it. And I was around EJ a lot at times when there were people and there weren't people. Well, when there were a lot of people, I was pretty busy because I was taking notes at that time too, just describing the events.
Having the question.
Yeah, there's having the question, being
the ability to formulate.
The ability to formulate it, to ask it. And if you ask EJ a question, you better have it fairly well formulated, or at least to the point that you can get help in it being formulated. And I guess it was too much in the emotional, and it was a burning question because your body actually gets to a higher temperature.
Correct me if I'm wrong. If I understand you right, you're saying that having the question, having the motivation or the drive to get a question answered, isn't enough necessarily for you to question out.
The
person over there also had the drive and the motivation. Somehow they formulated the question, and you go, oh, that's it. I never could come up with that, but that's my question.
Well, yeah, in the following year after a lot of talks.
The point is this, though. It's not external, Ivan.
Yeah.
She had the question.
Yeah.
The question is not the words written down.
That's right.
The mood that arose in you.
That's what I'm
and
looking at everybody around you, or I was in my events. Go ahead.
Yeah, and there is general concepts associated with it, but you don't know how to verbalize it to give the transmission.
Okay, but that's a secondary step to it.
Okay.
What I want to ask you about, both of you, is what is the mood associated with it? There's a clear, distinct...
It's a very intense.
And there's an element of fear to it.
Yes, definitely fear. and it's unrelenting. But you still, like, for me, I had to split my attention because, you know, I had, you know, obligations of working at the post that I do, and at the same time when I was around EJ privately, I had to do the things that I was expected to do, and yet, you know, I just, it was quite, you know, memorable for me.
Yeah, thank you for sharing that, Marvette. But so you're bringing something else to mind for me, which is that, you know, having been around, for example, this tradition we had of birthday questions, you know, around the dinner table here at EJ's table, and, you know, I know I had the experience a number of times that I would participate, or I'd be part of a group where someone was asking a question that was evidently intense, you know, that came out of that mood, that was, in essence, a question for that person. And I couldn't relate to the question, but I could tell from the presentation and from the fact that EJ would answer that question sometimes at great length, certainly seriously, but sometimes with an hour and a half or 2 hours of an answer, you know, that was for that person, that was an essence question.
There was...
What I'm saying is,
yeah.
I wouldn't necessarily rise to it myself. I wouldn't necessarily say, gee, that was something I would have liked to formulate. I would might be something like, boy, I would never cope with that question in 100 years. But for that, but it was obviously an essence question.
Okay. Okay. And the thing was is that the following year I was actually at the well, it wasn't really an event. We were in Lily's apartment, and there was a big group of us. And when the question was asked, and I recognized it, and was so the gratitude for it being asked, because it
the human biological machine.
Yeah. The initial asking of it was in New York, and I was just so grateful for it being addressed. Because it was such a key thing that I had lost some of the intensity because, you know, just life and the obligations I had, but it just sprang right back up again.
I think that's the case where I think that question in some form all of us can relate to, but that's why the book is so significant.
Okay, in that case, what I wanted to point out about that, because that's a perfect example, is the question was, quote-unquote, in the air. The question was in the air, and Marvette was a portal for it for a while, and then it shifted elsewise.
Mm-hmm.
In the form of the question isn't the critical quality of the central question we're talking about. Here's my example.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I had the fortunate experience of asking a number of questions during my cycle here. And after I'd been here not very long, it was my birthday question. And we were sitting up in the, when we were having those dinners up in the studio.
Upstairs.
Whatever that was called, that upstairs studio. And I remember being in there, and my question was, well, you know, and what is the work? So I was mocked by a few people, particularly people who had been around for quite a bit. Like, what an idiot.
Yeah, that's a good question myself.
Yeah, what an idiot you are.
Yeah.
So it wasn't the formulation. EJ spoke with penetrating depth for me
mm-hmm.
in answering that question. And that was the grapefruit talk.
The grapefruit talk, oh my gosh.
Do you remember that?
I remember listening to it.
Wasn't it
I don't.
Grapefruit and the ghost
talk?
I don't think I was. I don't think I was present for that.
I don't remember now that it was final, but it was that I recalled the mood of the question more than I recall the formulation, and EJ got the mood of it and then sincerity of the request. That's what he responded. It was profound.
Well, what in that case, I have a couple things to say. It was his original talk, which I think might have been back in the 70s. What I would think, this is how I would look at it, is that you had the sincerity that captured the kernel of it, that he could pull back on that space, draw it back, and paint it again, because the people present were not the same people, and there was enough necessity there to bring back that space and be able to give that transmission again.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I would say about that.
So part of the concept of asking a question is allowing yourself to be the portal, and the portal that requires a sense of sacrifice of who you are to be the portal for that moment. It's possible to do that and to be in that position. Go ahead.
That same question, if asked by somebody else without that mood, would not have been a real question.
Correct.
but also if you're acting as a portal in that moment, it also means that although it's your question, it isn't just for you.
Not at all. And that was apparent to me, Dan, that it had nothing to do with me. It was just an accident that I happened to be there. And the rest of it just flowed through as it was supposed to. So here's the last element of questions that I want to bring up. By its true essential nature of the word, having a question means you don't know. Right? Doesn't it seem this simple?
Yeah, right. It's a lot.
Stupidly simple.
It's a void or a lack of something. Yeah.
And most of the time we just go, oh, I don't know. But what about the moment just before that? When that question arises, you feel it. That's why I want us to observe the markers. What does it feel like when the question arises in us? We have the ability all day long to observe that. The question arises in us, but we don't want to stay in the place called, I don't know. Go ahead. Yeah.
I wanted to go back to that period of time in 1982, because one of the reasons I couldn't ask the question is because part of my job was taking notes, and I had a lot of ideas about it, and I knew that I had the burning question, but I knew that I couldn't ask it because I had, you know, I couldn't formulate it because there were too many ideas, and anything that came to me was like, oh no, that doesn't catch it. Those are ideas, you know. I knew that he would just swat it off.
Correct.
Good. So I never could get to asking it.
The sensation also of what the quality needed to be.
Yeah.
Which is very good.
Mm-hmm. If there are any questions, comments online.
If I did want to ask Marvette, there are comments online. I want to read those.
Thank you.
I want to ask Marvette if she thought, would it be possible then, in a case like that, to ask for help in formulating a question?
Yes, it would be, but I didn't feel like I could do that. I didn't feel like I had the ability. Perhaps if I wasn't so busy with the convention, because it was like a question cannot be about you.
Yeah.
And so, you know, and you may feel that burning necessity, and so there's a lot of, like, confusion because you know that you can't be drawing the focus to you, especially at an event that is, like, maybe, you know, a big event like that. And you don't know how to interface with, you know, fitting into, you know, anyways, I was not capable of that. But yes, it has been demonstrated many times at birthday questions when people do come with a question and they don't have it well formulated, but there's some kernel there that he does respond, he had, you know, he would respond to. And part of the talk was helping to formulate a clarity of the question.
Yeah. He's also had other people in the group help an individual define a question.
On an amateur level, right after I got here, we would often eat lunch over at the Szechuan restaurant in Grass Valley. And I had these senior guys, Menlo, you know, and Bill the Group, Tommy would show up, Parker. Mm-hmm. And Rudy often would show up. These were guys that had been around for years. They'd help me formulate questions. We bring up a question, how do you pose it?
Mm-hmm.
So, but that was like offline a little bit.
So. They got there.
Okay. Well, first of all, we have one that says, good comment, Brisa. That's from Garrett.
All right.
Let's see. William Alvin says, yes, definitely. That was to your first question.
Okay.
Muscle Spark says, yes, I have had times when questions that seem not be answerable have arisen, like Ivan's situation. And William Alvin says, yes, emotional. For myself, it must be brought about through some aspect of the emotional field. Bernie LaPlante says, Betty's story makes me think that a question may be asked at almost any time and place, but its answer may come in a special time and place.
Nice. Well put.
Yeah. Actually, I just want to say that all this talk here and this whole discussion brings to mind, there is a talk of the month which has always been very vivid for me, and I think it's because I was there during that dinner, during that talk, and so the transcript is always, you know, I'm able to bring my own, whatever, let's say, bodily, yeah, my
That's right.
my muscle memory, let's say, of being at that talk. But it was one where somebody had a birthday question and they were completely at sea. It was like, they couldn't formulate, they couldn't do the job at all. So E.J. said, okay, look, I'm going to give you guys a demonstration. We're going to switch places. If I were in your place and I had the teacher sitting at the head of the table and I had a question to ask, here's the question that I would ask. And, you know, anybody remember what that class talk is? I want to recommend that very strongly because here's what you had. You had E.J. saying to the students, he asked us the question. That's what he did, is he asked us, he says, this is, so if I had a birthday question, here's the kind of question I would formulate, see if you can answer this. What kind of answer would you come up with? And
nice.
Do you remember that?
I don't remember it.
He said, you know, I should know the title of the, it's in the night, among the 99 or 100 talk of the month, and I think it's, I'm trying to remember whose birthday it was. Doesn't matter whose birthday it was. I'll go and look up the title, but the, you know, I don't even want to blow it at this point by, you know what I mean? By misformulating, you know, by watering down his question. It was very powerful. It was a very powerful demonstration. I mean, we proceeded to work on the answer to that question. It was not easy. It was not an easy question. But it was a marvelous demonstration because E.J. was saying, like, geez, you guys, look at all this opportunity that you've thrown away. You guys have all these wretched, you know, superficial, like, not thought-out questions when you have this birthday once a year. Listen, here's what I would do. You just, like, knock down all the 10 pins.
Okay, but
here's a real question. You know.
Okay, but that's a good comment.
Yeah.
But right now, today, we don't have that, do we?
No, we
right
don't
now,
have it. But
at this moment, what I want to say, Ivan, is that's a great speculation, but what do we have now?
Actually, David, I just want to add that I think that part of what EJ was demonstrating right there was that by concentration, by his capability or his where he was sitting, he was capable of summoning that atmosphere
exactly.
and mood like that on
and
the spot.
Putting everybody
the
there,
question. Yeah.
Putting everybody there
yeah.
into the space of questions.
Yeah.
And I guess what I want to say is, like, we're old guys now. You know, we're all anywhere from 30 to 65 and 70. And so we already know how the world works pretty well. You know, we're pretty set. And
sure thing.
Yeah, well. But what I want to encourage is to use this chapter as a method of seeing how questions arise in you.
Mm-hmm.
Watch during the day. You might, you know, just say, why is that person driving like that? That's a question. You know, why is that he or she wearing that? Or look at that person. Why is that person wearing their hair like that? Maybe it just arises like that. See if you can notice in yourself the flower bed that arises from which a question arises.
Right, because if you're if you're observing that, if you're doing self-observation, then you will see, or you may have, you have the opportunity to see where is that question coming from.
Yeah, where is the question coming from? And if you allow it rather than buffer it out, there may be times when you can open something just a little bit, Ivan, and that the question can exist long enough to take hold. But then the suffering that you do is that then you're on this sea of unknowing, because by you don't know. Can you stand in that position of not knowing before you buffer it out into knowing everything about how the world works? Just a fun chapter.
Man, phone.
I think there's a factor of fascination in both. Thinking about times when I have a question, the easier times that the question just simply arises without much working on that, were some moments where my fascination over the situation, and there was no prejudgment or not too much association with what others might have said, or it was this trust in, okay, I'm experiencing this, and I know that if I go and ask, the majority of people are going to think that I'm crazy or something like that. So I had that knowledge, but I also trust that it made sense because there was this fascination too, and I allowed that to be present. And then that's when the question was very simple coming up to surface. And usually also the questions tend to be extremely simple in a way. There's no much, it can be even like three words many times, you know, it's just like this, 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 that's all.
Who am I?
Who am I? Yeah, well.
But that's the whole thing, is that the questions arise in simplicity. It's not mired with mentation. Go ahead.
Bernie LaPont says, sometimes I heard EJ or Claude answering what seemed to me a stupid question, but I always recall the phrase, talk to the wall, maybe the door will listen.
Okay.
I find it interesting, too, that often I'll hear something like that, that a question that strikes me as either irrelevant or not necessarily stupid, but just something that doesn't seem to me to apply. And Claude will find either he hears it differently and hears what the person is actually saying, or he'll find an angle on it that relates to what he's saying, and I totally miss it.
Yeah, well, Claude's very, very creative in that way. Very creative. So is Pat. She'll pick stuff up that just, who knew? So the whole thing is just allow the word, the sensation of questioning to be alive in you, because that'll free you from the constraints of should I ask or I should know that, things like that. Allow the question to be there. Allow yourself to be in that mode of fascination. And from there, you'll see a whole new world. Well, that's it. Thank you for coming this evening. We'll look forward to seeing you next week at 7 o'clock. Good night.
Thank you, David.
Thank you, David.